so much. Good morning, everyone. It's my honour to have been asked to introduce Yasmin this morning. And of course, having been asked to do something, I'd rather not just mention a name and then sit down. So I'd like to give a little bit of background about Yasmin, focusing on her scholarly career rather than her other sort of intellectual and family interests. Because I think it's important to remember that whilst we're here as scholars, it's not all that we do, and our scholarship isn't the only sort of field of outlet for our creativity and our interests. I've known Yasmin incredibly now for nearly a decade, which shocked me when I thought about it. In 2012, she returned to Oxford University after, I think, what was a significant spell teaching at Royal Holloway, University of London. At Oxford, she teaches a range of courses on imperial and Commonwealth history, British history, world, and I suppose what we all now call global history. But I suppose relevant to us today, indicating the high regard in which she and her work are held, she has also held a range of prestigious grants and fellowships throughout her career, I think starting with a British Academy postdoctoral fellowship, going through Leverhulme and AHRC-funded projects subsequent to that. So these places, these institutions, but above all her own endeavour and appetite for ambitious projects, have yielded her an international reputation as a scholar of a variety of things, which I would characterise as colonialism, gender, migration, and overall British and Asian history. This has been manifest, of course, in a number of articles and chapters, but most notably in the form of prize-winning and widely and positively reviewed big books. The main ones, of course, being a book on the partition of India, called The Great Partition, and the recent book, The Raj at War. So it's a great pleasure that I'm able to introduce Yasmin and thank her for coming to see us all and speak to us and engage with us today. And the theme of her lecture, the heading of the title is Together? Colonised Women in the British Empire, Second World War Experiences. Yasmin.
Thank you very much for that, Ashley. And I also worked out that it's been almost 10 years since we first met, and I think you'll see the imprint of Ashley's work on Empire and Second World War throughout this lecture. He's been a huge influence in terms of his own pioneering work on Empire and the Second World War. Britain's part and the British Empire's part in the Second World War are still coming to full historical fruition. Events, archives, and concepts are still being fully digested and understood. Knowledge of imperial involvement or integration of imperial resistance, which goes beyond mere fetishization of the black or Asian soldier, is still emerging. I probably don't have to tell many of you in this audience this. The ways in which civilians were caught up in the Blitz or even in Stalingrad may be well known, but when it comes to Algeria, China, the Caribbean or India, such histories have only just begun to emerge and to register on narratives of wartime. One example that struck me, for instance, is the Vijay commemorations that happened in 2015. The Royal British Legion's commemoration was televised by the BBC, but they weren't able to feature an interview or a conversation with one single African or Asian veteran, male or female, despite the producer's best attempts to find a veteran from the 14th Army. Now, of course, time is an issue there, but that's despite the fact that three quarters of those in the 14th Army, which fought the battles at Coma and Imphal in 1944, weren't white British soldiers, but men from colonised places, including Nigeria, Nepal and present-day Pakistan, as well as, of course, India. The reading on that day by the actor Charles Dance of Kipling's 19th century poem Mandalay at the official drumhead ceremony in the presence of David Cameron and the Queen, which was a much-loved song sung by British troops in India, also struck me at the time as slightly odd, because the poem talks of heathen idols and the sexual allure of Burmese women. Burmese woman waiting for the return of her soldier, wasting Christian kisses on an heathen idol's foot. Now, this is exactly the same poem which caught out Boris Johnson recently on a visit to Burma when he was videoed reciting it in a Burmese temple. So Whether in the fiction of Paul Scott or the reportage of John Masters, this sort of Orientalist sensual allure of the East was an intrinsic part of war history in Asia. Now, again, probably among many of this audience, I don't need to go into too much detail about the history of empire and war, but just to sort of give an underscoring of the general importance of empire to the war. It wasn't just a battle site, but also a supplier of provisions, the movement of men, and of a space for battles also. 2.5 million men, famously, from South Asia, 500,000 men from Africa, being contributed to the troops, but vast rises in expenditure in those countries. Labour conscription in Africa to tin mines and plantation works, and a kind of global system of imperial defence, which Ashley has so eloquently depicted in his work. The empire had a dual role during the Second World War. It was both the scene of actual battle and territorial struggle, most obviously and notably in the struggle between the British and Japanese Empire, and after 1942, when that eastern chunk of the British Empire had fallen completely to the Japanese. But it was also a sort of expansive home front, even in areas where fighting didn't take place or that were never actually captured, including India. I would include a lot of India in that. But also in parts of the Middle East and across Africa, a barrack for hundreds of thousands of soldiers who were being moved around in readiness for fighting. Indians and British, but also American, African, Chinese and Australians. A site of refuge for refugees, for Poles, for instance, who ended up in India. Anglo-Burmans, Burmese Indians, Indians from Southeast Asia, all shifting around trying to find safety. And it became a training ground and a munitions plant, with imperial cities from Nairobi to Calcutta swelling as labourers flocked towards inflated wartime wages and subsidised food in factory works, in munitions and textiles, but also in things like medicines and vaccines. And many cities, especially port cities, were rest and recreation grounds for the many soldiers waiting for action or coming back from war or waiting around in transit. So the empire was being changed by war, from propaganda to strategic thinking, and sort of underpinned by an idealised vision of imperial togetherness, hence this famous Together poster. I think it's important to remember also that food was absolutely pivotal in all of this, food shortages and food deprivation. The Middle Eastern supply chain is often celebrated as a success story relative to India's famine of 1943. But there was a shadow of famine in Syria, in Lebanon, in French Algeria too. And I think more finely grained studies into the future will find more stories of starvation deaths. In Kenya, there were shortages of staple, of maize. There were imports. You know, we're affecting food across parts of the empire. And Bengal sort of stands at the pinnacle of that story, where up to 3 million people died in that terrible famine in 1943. So, as in Britain, colonial states had to deliver propaganda, organise information, assess internal security and police dissent, respond to these movements of refugees and reorient their economies to wartime production. There were air raid precautions, there were drills, there were propaganda, all the same sorts of things that were happening in Britain. And this brought all sorts of unforeseen problems and challenges to everyday colonial administration and affected people's lives across the empire. But my subject today is really about women and gender, and particularly colonised women in the empire. So, if empire is the elephant in the room when we discuss the war in Britain, then the women are doubly invisible. The presence of women from the British Empire in the war is quite sort of startling in how far it's missing from even sort of very cutting edge and recent publications like the 3-volume Cambridge History of the Second World War. And although when I was researching India's experience in the Second World War, it wasn't a history about women specifically, but I was kind of drawing on Antoinette Burton's idea that you can diversify and broaden the archive, you can try and find women wherever they are located. And they are visible and present. Now, obviously, particularly in representations of women, and it's easy to find visual representations of women, of propaganda pictures from pin-ups of Lana Turner and Marlene Dietrich, which were a major part of morale-boosting and propaganda. But I also wanted to look beyond the sort of the visual imagery and beyond that representation and try and find something about agency, the role taken by women beyond their representations and sort of pin-up roles, sort of empirically grounded in social history. So to try and actually find out what happened to women. And even for that, visual sources can be quite a good source. There's a lot of propaganda photography, and I'll show you some of it, which can tell us something about the experience of women, which hasn't made it necessarily into textual sources. And we can look at some of those images. Because obviously the personal accounts of illiterate women are the hardest sort of thing to get to, particularly as time goes on and they're no longer alive. But there are other ways, also in the archive, that you can see the presence of women. I mean, surprisingly, sex work and prostitution is one of the most accessible in some ways, because it's one of those areas that the militaries were very concerned with. You know, they're very worried about the health of men and about the men being invalided out of service because of venereal disease. So actually, that's one of the places where you can see quite a lot of information about the lives of women in colonised societies. And I'd argue that there are commonalities in women's experience in the empire, in the colonies, and I here mean the sort of, I'm really talking about Asia and Africa, despite sort of allowing for the similarities, the differences in these places also. And the ways in which mothers feared their sons going off to war, universal themes, the difficulties caused by long absences and lack of postal contact, very long periods without leave and absences sometimes of 6 or 7 years, and familial conflicts and questions over remittances and broken marriages as a result. Also, I mean, again, familiar from Europe, the broader way in which women start to replace men in the workforce, and the sexual politics of interactions with soldiers. I think you can see lots of these things happening globally. So the question I'm sort of asking in this lecture is, what might a truly global and sort of feminist history of the Second World War look like? What might histories that take seriously imperial experiences of the war read? How might they read? And how might we give some equivalence of voice to people who weren't on the front line of war, weren't actually in places invaded, they weren't in the heartlands of Europe's bloodlands, but they still lived on the imperial home front in a way. Their lives were still being radically shaped by the involvement of the British Empire in the war. And I'll kind of dig into detail on four aspects. One of those is exactly those family relationships. Another is labour. The third one is prostitution. And finally, a little bit about politics and political resistance. Begum Bano lived in a village in Attock, a district of Punjab, with a long history of military service. She couldn't write, but she employed a letter writer to pen a letter on her behalf on August 6, 1941, which she authenticated with her inky thumbprint. Her 25-year-old son, Amir Dad, was serving in the Punjab regiment and had been sent to Aden. She had received the shattering news that he'd been court-martialed while he was away in the Middle East and imprisoned, and her letter appealed to the government on her son's behalf. Unfortunately, he and the other sepoy, junior soldier Karamdad, fought with each other, and my son has been sentenced to 7 years imprisonment and is now in jail in Pune. The humble petitioner is old and weak of age and too poor to see her son at Pune. She hasn't seen her son for the last 3 years, and she is very anxious to see her son at Pune. She is given to grief day and night, and her condition deserves pity. She has legs in grave. She is too poor to defray journey expenses of about rupees 60 to Pune. Moreover, on account of old age, she is unable to undertake her journey. May her son kindly be transferred to Rawalpindi jail near his home so that before her death she can have the last visit of her son, which is her earnest prayer and cherished desire. Now, this sepoy had caused hurt with a dangerous weapon to another soldier, to another sepoy, and he'd been given 7 years rigorous imprisonment and dismissal from service on the first day of the new year in 1941. But his mother's appeal found the support of a sympathetic civil servant, and he was moved to that jail. Now, I think this anecdote, in a way, tells us about the way that mothers, in particular, become very important to colonial recruitment in Asia. especially in places where there wasn't conscription. We always hear about the volunteer nature of the Indian Army. And in some places, mothers were very resistant to their sons going to war. Mothers in Nepal, in particular, there's a lot of evidence that they hid their sons, tried to keep them away from recruiting parties, sent them up into more isolated hills or out of the villages to stay with relatives. The richer the family, the more likely its young men were to escape the recruiting parties. And other mothers resorted to pleading and emotional blackmail to try to stop their sons from going. Meaning that some young men, in a spirit of adventurism or loyalism, left without their parental permission. And it's striking to me that from 1943, the Raj awarded medals to mothers. Mothers who had a husband or two or more children in the services, or any parent with three children serving, could now be the recipients of a special imperial medal. And I think it was a recognition of the heavy reliance on certain families by the state in the 1940s, and of the part that all family members played in encouraging their youth to serve. As elsewhere, there was also the concerns about broken marriages, remittances, and relationships with the home community as keeping the morale of the serving soldier. This is a poster from East Africa, a propaganda sort of picture from East Africa, which apparently says, write to a soldier every month. And the idea in this poster is that an illiterate woman is shown how she can go to a clerk or to a letter writer, dictate a letter to a serving soldier, go to the Post and Telegraph office. On the reverse of it, there's detailed instructions about what kind of envelope to use, that you didn't have to apply a stamp if it was on a military military-provided envelope. And then this, you see the soldier in the final square receiving the letter, and the other soldier who's got his head in his hands currently distraught because he hasn't had one. But communications were very poor, and it was lots of stories, like elsewhere, of people going years without hearing from their husbands, and stories of divorce that ensued. Women would often move back in with their own parents while the husband was away from home, particularly if they still had young children. And Nazir Begum in India was becoming a burden, and her family was no longer in a position to support her, but she'd had no sign of remittance from overseas, so she wasn't getting the payment back from her soldier's donation or sort of remittance. So she wrote a letter to his commanding officer asking that a divorce, threatening divorce, if the soldier continued to refuse remittance. At the end, I will also request, if he's not willing to provide for my maintenance, he can by all means extricate me from his clutches by a divorce deed. So for a woman in such a position, this fate was worse than that of a war widow, as she wasn't able to access any kind of pension or hardship fund, and she didn't see the benefits of her husband's pay packet. So I think, as elsewhere in the world, there were a lot of women waiting and worrying in the empire during the Second World War. But it also had harder material repercussions for the women left behind, the fact that then so many men were absent. And of course, I'm talking about disparate places in a way, but there were a number of similarities for women doing unskilled work or semi-skilled work with a lack of unionisation, with petty forms of control and management in civilian labour that supplied the war effort. So, for instance, wartime regulations often undermined labour laws that had been advancements in the 1930s. So, in India, working underground in mines had been banned for women, but this law was reversed due to the pressing need for coal in wartime, and now the issue became how late into pregnancy they might continue working in the mines. And on other major aerodrome and road construction sites across Asia, Chinese, Burmese, Indian and African women labourers worked, often in bare feet and with basic pickaxe and shovel. In Britain, we know that the number of women in the industrial workforce went up from a quarter to a third between 1939 to 43. And elsewhere, it's hard to find statistics, but we can completely see the entry of more women into the industrial labour force. You can see here, I love this photo of women cleaning tank parts in India. And this is what I mean about the sort of visual evidence that's available that tells stories perhaps that aren't available in textual sources. The war was also shaping the nature of agricultural work, and the absence of men was determining the nature of women's work, often increasing the quantity of manual work to be done. In Nepal, for instance, where intensive recruitment of Gurkhas was taking place, and brothers, husbands, and fathers vanished, and there was little support for women who now had much longer days. Their days might now start at 5 in the morning, ending at 10 or 11 at night, husking rice, cooking and cleaning, collecting firewood, water, and fodder. As a Nepali woman recalled to Mary Ann Sheen, an anthropologist who did great work on this subject a number of years ago, "I hear the whole world was fighting, but why they needed my son's father to settle it, I can't understand." And sometimes in East African rural areas, where men were being recruited, were being conscripted into the formalised industrial labour force, it was the women who were left with the farming work. So you see these sort of chains, knock-on effects, with conscript labour in Kenya. Elsewhere, women building aerodromes in the northeast, and in particular, the Lado Road, the Stillwell Road that ran through from China to Burma through to India, that road's construction rested on a bedrock of Asian labour, and many of those involved were women. You can see there nearly all these workers pictured in this photograph are women. Particularly in the early days of the road, when accommodation and supplies had been barely assembled, the risk of death for taking on work in that region was high, partly through disease and partly through things like landfalls. Barefooted men and women heaped baskets of rocks and building materials on their heads and broke rocks with pickaxes. Slim, who was the commander in that region, remembered them at work with pick, shovel and basket roads made by human labour with almost a laughable lack of machinery. And one account recalled many of these workers were dumped in anonymous roadside graves that impoverished families never notified. One British engineer could point to an area on the road where 600 of his own coolies had died. So there's a hard cost to some of this labour as well. Thinking about my third point, which is about sexual labour. One of the most striking aspects when thinking about the contact between soldiers and colonial women in the Second World War is how much latitude there was in many towns and cities for contact between soldiers and local people. As we know, fighting is just one part of soldiering. And often men's experience in the African and Asian wars would alternate between long times without the presence of women, on ship, in desert, or later on in jungle, and then times in bustling colonial cities and port cities. And during those times, men could go about in cities such as Cairo, Bombay, Calcutta, visit shops and markets, cinemas, dances and bars, use the services of tailors, rickshaw pullers, taxi drivers, and canteen owners. But there was also, of course, the chance to go to brothels. And their status shifted during the war. They're not unregulated by any means. But in the first 3 years of the war, I was surprised to find how there was direct support for organised prostitution in the manner of the lock hospitals of Victorian Britain. So in Cairo, where large numbers of troops from Britain, India, South Africa, New Zealand and Australia had massed by the early 1940s, ready for the Middle Eastern and North African campaigns, the Red Light District was kind of a well-known attraction. It was almost a sort of mandatory part of the soldiers' tour. This had a semi-official status, as the brothels were called tolerated brothels, and the women were licensed. There was a system of medical inspections of women sex workers twice weekly by Egyptian doctors. And that was directly supported by the British Army, which continued to sanction it up until 1943. Now, about 1943, that starts to change, and the tide starts to change, as there's an increasing recognition of both both moral pressure. I mean, the Americans had different views on this. They were less tolerant of tolerated brothels, but also the effects of venereal disease on manpower. The enforcement of out-of-bounds areas or prohibition on visiting brothels depended on the strength of conviction of commander, though. It wasn't often when there were rules in place, they were honoured more in the breach than to the letter. And the efficiency of the military police in Palestine, in other places, continued while restrictions were placed on Port Said and Suez. In Alexandria, representatives of the Royal Navy made a successful appeal that local brothels should remain in bounds. And one of the first tasks for military commanders on the capture of Asmara, the Eritrean city, following the eventual fall of Keren, was the establishment of two sets of official brothels, racially segregated, one for British troops and the other for Indians, and a separate one for officers. After the fall of Tripoli and Benghazi to the Eighth Army, there are records in the military papers, there's suggestions of problems and a brief period of chaos in relationship to local women. And just to give a sense of the scale, that this isn't just a peripheral issue, this wasn't minor or insignificant. In Cairo, it was estimated by the military authorities that 90,000 men a month were visiting the Wag el Barka area for sex. And in a 1944 survey of two American bases in India, approximately 60% of the men surveyed said that they'd had sex in the China-Burma-India theatre and had paid for it. So that leads back to representation, you know, the sort of depressingly familiar tropes of the Oriental women that kind of appear, the natives being sort of entrapping naive and innocent and gullible young soldiers. And you find these sort of tropes and stereotypes across some of the literature. But I think the women weren't just passive victims. They weren't just again, it's hard to get to their voices or their agency, but they weren't. They were also often benefiting or at least negotiating their own position. There's an extraordinary letter that I found in the British Library from Aden, where a vicious quarrel broke out between women who accused each other of stealing business from each other and wrote an aggrieved letter to the medical officer at the RAF hospital, accusing the government of giving preferences to certain houses in the same lane. "We are all British subjects living under the protection of the British flag," the letter goes, "and it's expected that all the prostitutes will be dealt with fairly and equally." And it's signed by Arab, Indian, Abyssinian and Somali girls. It says, we wish to be free to accept European soldiers in our houses, and by granting our request, we shall forever pray for the victory of our gracious king against his foe, the most wicked aggressor, Hitler, the destructor of Germany and breaker of world peace." Now, that's a kind of, there's so many things we could say about that letter. And we don't know how it was written exactly. The intermediaries perhaps used in writing the letter. But expressions of loyalism could take all manner of guises and exist for all manner of reasons. Elsewhere, cohabitation, marriage and more sustained relationships weren't uncommon either. And there's a whole kind of spectrum, I suppose, of those relationships that can be told about the Second World War. There was also a political resistance to this, and on the nationalist side, at least in India, there was quite strongly organised opposition to increases in visible prostitution in Indian cities, which I don't have time to talk about, but is of itself interesting. Finally, moving into something different, there's the actual women who work in uniform themselves. And the military propaganda was very keen to stress the liberation that wartime work could deliver and tended to emphasise the freedom and adventurism available. For middle-class women and women in the Dominions, this was often the case. And even in India, as one auxiliary nursing service advertisement put it, "Society no longer requires a girl to be a stay-at-home idler." Roles in the auxiliary services were hard won and often meant overcoming resistance from Whitehall. There was the Women's Auxiliary Corps, India, 11,500 women in that, often Anglo-Indian or Anglo-Burmese Indian Christians. There were women fighting for recognition as part of the Allied forces and struggling to be permitted to take on roles in the ATS and other services. Caribbean women volunteers, who imagined themselves coming to the assistance of an imaginary homeland, had their initial appeals to join the ATS rejected. This wasn't a monolithic imperial response, so there were differences between individuals and institutions with sort of interesting arguments going on about the status of women or the possible status of women in the armed forces. Often the Colonial Office and the India Office were prepared to go further and faster towards some semblance of equality than the War Office. That was certainly the case in the question of the Caribbean women joining the ATS. They were more aware of public opinion in the colonies. It was the War Office's official policy, for instance, for the first 4 years of the war to discourage black women from joining the ATS. And in 1943, the Colonial Office managed to persuade the War Office that the recruitment of black Caribbean women would be an asset. And it was later that year that the first batch of 30 West Indian women were recruited. British nurses and from the Dominion struggled to care for their charges and were working at the sort of rock face of war. They also acted as whistleblowers, often making persistent demands on authorities and very sort of horrified by the conditions of their patients. Lillian Catherine Pert, in her mid-40s, was volunteering as a nurse in Indian general hospitals throughout the war, in Karachi and later in South India, doing, as she believed, the most exhausting work physically and mentally that an educated English woman can undertake in this country. Now, she was pointing out in letters to her superiors differences between hospitals for Indian troops and hospitals for foreign soldiers. And she was writing these quite sort of persistent letters, worried about the lack of doctors as well as nurses. What will be the conditions in overseas hospitals staffed if heavy casualties start coming in from a future Burma campaign? Something must be done before we are swamped with casualties from the Far East. I should hate to have it on my conscience that I condemned by inaction these future casualties the same neglect as was suffered by seriously wounded men of the 4th Indian Division in Karachi and so on. So she was flagging up these ideas, and she's not the only one. There were other nurses, senior nurses, writing, documenting sort of injustices or at least inequalities in the treatment of soldiers. My final point is about those who were involved in sort of political resistance and politics during the Second World War. And I don't have a great deal of time to go into it, but I suppose I'm interested also in some of those women who became involved in the Indian National Congress, in political movements during the Second World War, were able to actually become more prominent inside those organisations than they would have been earlier. And one example of that is this woman here, Aruna Asaf Ali. She stood in the shadow of her husband, but like many middle-class and elite women in the politics of the 1940s, she was becoming more actively involved in social work. Just before the war started, she just turned 30. And her husband was a very prominent member of the Indian National Congress. She was convent educated. She'd married him against her parents' wishes. She already had sort of imprint of a rebel slightly, but she was also just known as a sort of society hostess and held soirees at her house. But by 1940, she'd become caught up in the intensity of political feeling sweeping the country. And there was a sort of generational division between some of these younger women and their elders. Her husband was arrested when the Quit India movement broke out, and when he was preemptively arrested with other Congress leaders as a potential rebel. But in a way, they got the wrong person, because that day that he was arrested was a sort of tipping point for Aruna Asaf Ali, and she became a kind of underground resistor against the British Empire. She went to public square, raised a flag, then she headed a procession, and during this sort of battle with local police, she ended up going underground. Her house was seized, her husband remained in prison, and she went on the run. The government offered a 5,000 rupee reward for her capture, and for the rest of the war she was broadcasting on underground radios, in defiance of the empire. For the next 4 years, she remained on the run, sort of wearing disguises and staying in different people's houses, resisting calls to come out of hiding, even from people like Gandhi. Now, when her finally, at the end of the war, she did come out of hiding. Her marriage hadn't survived. Her husband went off to become the first ambassador from India to Washington, D.C. But she remained in India as an important sort of leading Congress politician and later a mayor of Delhi. But I think what I'm interested in that story is the fact that in her case, her route was conditioned by the politics that she was associated with. But actually, in a way, she has a lot more in common with some of those other middle-class women who become involved in war work and social work. Just because she was resisting the war, actually some of her social experiences, the kind of way that she started to become more active in the public sphere, the way that she felt that she could speak, the way she cut her hair, the way she ended up sort of leading a movement, had more in common perhaps with some of the Indian women in the auxiliary services than she would have liked to have thought. Although there's loyalism and imperialism that cut across these, and nationalism that cut across some of these stories, actually some of the experiences of women might have more commonalities than we imagine. So all of this raises methodological questions of how we study warfare over the long durée of the European empires. The interconnectedness of imperialism and modern warfare are questions which transcend any individual war. By World War II, almost all of the countries where the British had military bases were part of the British Empire. So the two are completely connected. And some sort of tales of togetherness, I think I'm telling a rather different tale to the idea that everyone is in it together in the British Empire, as the together poster might suggest, or that war created a sort of racial melting pot or a kind of simplistic blending. Where this did take place, it was still deeply stratified and gendered. Rather, I'd suggest that wartime deepened authoritarianism, actually, in some parts of the empire. And even in places with long histories of uninterrupted British rule, the commencement of the war saw a retrenchment of devolution, more reliance on centralised state power, the use of defence acts, more power to imperial administrators than they had actually enjoyed for a number of years. And women's lives were shaped by that, they were affected by that. So gendered histories of global warfare in the 20th century are about far more than restoring women's voices and agencies to an otherwise static picture. I think it's more than just sort of memorialising women's role in the war, perhaps. The real challenge might be to reframe the war and to show the layers of coercion sometimes, or at least hierarchies of gender and race that intersected with the British war effort. And this isn't a call for kind of crass moral relativism. I mean, the Japanese comfort women were systematically and brutally state organised. The empire wasn't comparable to totalitarian regime. I'm not suggesting that for a second. But war itself is brutal. And among the Allies, just sustaining the war had some exploitative and sort of extractive and coercive elements that I think impacted on women's lives. And I think the trouble is how to tell that while also celebrating, in some ways, those women's role. Rather than just restoring the presence of black and Asian people or women to the picture, as war memorials have tended to do, the problem is one of continuing to unpack the interconnectedness and interdependence of British warfare and British imperialism. And the two are often just sort of treated as separate bits of history. There's the war and there's the empire. But there was obviously considerable overlap and interdependence between the two. I think the diversity of individual experiences is one way to understand that. They were bringing into dialogue two historical scenarios, which are often regarded as inhabiting separate domains. And real engagement with Britain's imperial history of the Second World War is uncomfortable and a bit disturbing in a number of ways. And I think we have to grapple with these questions of that discomfort that comes with actually recognising also the role in imperial and colonial warfare, going beyond the recovery of black and Asian voices and trying to actually recover the voices of people in these regions as fully fledged and complex historical actors in their own right.
Yasmin, thank you very much indeed. Are you happy to remain standing?
We've got
a good amount of time now, 15 minutes by that clock, for some discussion. But I'd just like to abuse the chair to start with, in terms of a vote of thanks, but also, I suppose, a reflection on some of these themes. And just for us all to think about just why these things are so important, and why our work, why everything that we do as scholars interested in this field is just so important. Because I think if we look at the general historiographies, which of course these are the targets for many of us, we all know that specialists exist and that we all know these things in a room like this. The problem is that the wider record and wider society doesn't acknowledge these things. The unremitting focus on combat, and as Yasmin has mentioned, politics, strategy, it continues to trump social, economic, cultural histories of the war. And it is our jobs, it is the result, the product, I suppose, the target of work like Yasmin's and the work that many of us do here is to try and do something to shift that. And to help people understand that the war efforts of all of the belligerent powers were absolutely founded on the resources, the physical infrastructure, the people of colonial and semi-colonial regimes. It was a war, regions rather, of the world. It was a war that touched all other parts of the war. So I think that this kind of history that agglomerates, that compares and brings things together is absolutely essential to try and shift the mainstream understanding and to ensure that we don't continue with ideas about our war and their war and get a much more holistic understanding of empire, the end of empire, and of war, because or else people just don't understand where we are today. So I think that the kind of work that Yasmin has outlined here as an agenda, the kind of work that we're all doing in this room, or many of us are, is absolutely crucial. Anyway, it'd be great if there are any questions or any just perspectives that people would like to offer. They don't have to be a direct question to Yasmin, but I'm more than happy to field questions for her.
Thanks, James. That was really fascinating. Thanks, Yasmin, especially the end, your kind of your the methodological stuff about how we can take this forward. Yeah. But just, I've been thinking over the last few years, and I think I've come to this, I've come to this really late as a historian of Britain in the Second World War, who's really belatedly thinking about Britain as part of a much wider collection of nations, a much wider collection of experiences, about how we take forward not just how we bring into conversation not just the history of the Second World War and history of empire, but how we also bring into that conversation history of gender and history of women, because they've also often been, with a few, including you, a few people who have worked on this, they've largely been really discrete areas of research. And how do we take that methodological step that you suggest at the end, how do we take that forward, particularly for people like me who've worked on Britain rather than on India or other areas of the empire, and how those kind of coalesce and come together? Sorry, that's a huge question.
It's really,
but it's just
good
something
question
to be thinking about.
For me personally, I suppose it's about tipping the balance slightly away from military to civilian in a broader sense. I mean, it's about sort of saying that actually, you know, lives are equal, lives are lives, and that, you know, what happened to civilians in all parts of the world and in Britain, you know, and in Russia and, you know, everywhere, kind of aren't secondary to the effects on soldiers, I suppose. But that's a very general answer. But I think within that, you know, then of course gender becomes more prominent because women are more likely to be civilians than they are to be soldiers. I mean, just by its nature, military history that focuses on campaigns and soldiers is gendered in a particular way. So if we can kind of expand that focus, we are by its nature then encompassing gender, potentially. But military history can be gendered too. Of course, it can think about masculinity and it can think about gender in all sorts of other ways. And I think actually one of those things that's also really important, which I only touched on but is very important, is that relationship between the soldier and the home and the connection to him. Because I think that's something that militaries themselves were, you know, deeply concerned with and worried about, the effects on morale and fighting kind of morale but also the sort of social context the soldiers are coming out of, you know, obviously that. So that's one place where we might bridge the gap more.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Lawson from Bookham University. It's a slightly kind of, well, I think my question will emerge.
Yes.
Really, and it's, just, it's not really the subject of your talk, but you, when you're talking at the end, you're talking about the coercive nature of some aspects of empire, and then you kind of felt the need to say, but of course it's not comparable to totalitarian regimes.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, well, and you had a picture of a road that's being built, and you told the story of you know, 600 people being buried at the side of the road. Now, if you told that story in the context of a totalitarian regime, we'd have said that was evidence of the kind of the contempt for human life of those kind of regimes. So I'm just, in a sense, why do we have to qualify by saying, well, there's nothing comparable about that, when actually what you gave was an example of something that was entirely comparable. I mean, you can think of examples of, you know, road building schemes in German road building schemes that are built back in Jewish labour, where we would tell that story with a very different kind of moral.
I mean, it's not. I totally see what you're saying. It's not forced labour in the totalitarian model. I mean, this is free market labour. You know, it's the free market is king in prostitution, in the world of prostitution, in the world of labour, in the British Empire during this period. You know, if you want to work for money, you can do it, and you can. That might mean taking on incredible risks. So it's a very different thing to totalitarian labour camps where people are forcibly moved against their will. Having said that, there's some very grey areas. You know, people are recruited by sort of in levies to go and work on the tea plantations. Then they find that they're actually being moved from the tea plantations up into the Lido Road. Now, the risks involved in working on the Lido Road were much higher than working on a tea plantation. So there's there's some sort of odd grey areas around those things. But it's not. I think there is a different relationship to rights and to freedom and to compulsion generally, but some of the effects actually, you know, can be cataclysmic. I mean, the same with the Bengal famine. I mean, it's not a deliberate act of malice, but at the same time, just through that control of food and through the prioritization of military needs for food, there's this terrible cataclysmic event that happens. So I would maintain the distinction with the fascist and totalitarian regimes at every step, but I think it doesn't mean that some of the effects, it's all subjective, it's where you're standing. If you for some particular individual, the effects might have felt as bad as potentially for some people, but it's, you know.
So I just kind of wanted to know a little bit more about how you actually have gone about finding these voices, and kind of as an offshoot of that, whether or not there's potentially a danger in there being so few that you kind of can take them at face value.
Yeah.
Perhaps?
Yeah, no, there is that sort of cherry-picking kind of thing that happens, because it is just the random letter that pops up. I mean, so some of the, you know, that letter petitioning of an officer for potentially for divorce if the remittance isn't returned, I mean, that's in the British Indian Army officer's papers, and it's just in there, in with all lots of other stuff. You know, his diaries and things, it's something that he received personally. So that's where, so you can, I mean, I think you can find these things, but they're never, there's never an archive, you know, it's not a discrete archive, they're woven through other places. I think it is, it is a problem, but I also think so much history of gender has gone in the direction of representation and of discursive analysis of texts and of vision, you know, of trying to understand gender as a sort of field of discursive production. And actually, you know, these are real. I think it's just important to, where we can, try and find out what happened to people. But we're not, they're few and far between. They're not going to be... There are some older histories. I mean, for instance, on the Bengal famine, there was a great historian in the 1970s who did a really good study of the Bengal famine. And he went and found women who had worked as sex workers during the 1940s in Bengal and interviewed them. And you can find, you know, there's individual names, stories, they're all in that history. So you can find things that people have done in the sort of last 50 years. Occasionally there are still individuals who are being interviewed.
Can I just say, yeah. It does make you think, doesn't it, about a massive oral history project, because there are still enough people.
There are still enough
the
people.
Networks are excellent. I mean, you're finding people. It wouldn't be difficult. And it does make you think, doesn't it, about some kind of massive project, especially because oral history projects have such cachet and get funding.
I mean, there's a lot of class distinction as well. I mean, someone like Aruna Asaf Ali, she was interviewed, there's masses of papers, her private papers have been collected in the Indian archives in Tirumurti. I mean, you can find quite a lot about her quite quickly. So it's the hardest people are obviously always going to be the illiterate peasant or the labourer, industrial worker, industrial labourer. And I think there's kind of harder social and economic history that could be done through statistical analysis, through looking at kind of labour production in specific industries as well. I mean, I think that sort of thing could be done too, which wouldn't get to the voices of the individuals, but would tell more about their actual social kind of conditions.
Great. One more question. So...
Thank you. That was wonderful. Just on the oral history projects, I mean, I think that there is still space to do that, and I think the community archives of Pakistan are doing a lot of interviewing, but they're focusing on partition.
Yeah. There's so much emphasis on partition. It's extraordinary compared to just the few years previous to that.
Yeah. I wanted to pick up on something you said at the beginning, which is about fetishization of the Black and Asian soldier, which I think is really interesting idea, and this kind of sense that there is a hierarchy of worth or a hierarchy of suffering or a hierarchy of story that is worth telling, you know, and that at the highest level of that is the soldier with the VC or kind of the great kind of traditional wartime traditional war film type story, if you like. But I think that is still very much in place. But I think there are kind of also, there are a good story will break through, I think for me the example of that is Nella Last and the Housewife 49 story, which was just such an ordinary tale in a way, but she wrote it so well.
It's such a good source, isn't it?
And there's been other examples like the movie Land Girls, which is not on the same level, but nevertheless it's still kind of telling that woman's story of ordinary experience, in an extraordinary time that becomes extraordinary experience.
Yeah.
So I guess my shout out is for the power of a good story and the ability to find a good story and to tell it well.
And I think part of the attraction of Second World War histories, certainly in popular histories, is the storytelling, is the heroism, is the big grand narrative, and that is part of it. And I think in terms of communicating beyond the academy, we have to, really recognise that. So it's, I think you're right, but I think it does relate to the question about sources, because there aren't, the Nella Last, I haven't yet heard of or seen the Nella Last diary from the empire, from a colonised woman's perspective. Although I think you would get it for some of, nurses, for instance. I think Commonwealth, Dominion nursing, really undervalued and understudied. And there are some really good memoirs for that. And you could do interviews and memoirs for that. And there's some incredible stories of people's moving such long distances, being in quite remote locations and dealing with quite difficult situations. So, I think they are there. They must be there, some of these stories.
We will leave it there.
Okay.
And thank
you.
Remains to thank Yasmin very, very much indeed.
Thanks
very much.
Thank you.